I crossed 100,000 subscribers in the first 6 months of doing this project.
Wow. You started it in January 2017. You have a little over 200,000 subscribers today.
I didn't set out to like start a newsletter. It very much was like, we're just going to do this now. 27 days in, and there's like $34,000 in that PayPal account.
Oh my God.
There is so much more like value being created here than I anticipated.
It's one of those things that sounds so easy on paper, but actually is such a skill.
This is an inherently biased product. This is the news through like one person.
Are there one or two other times in your 9 years of doing this where you've stepped on something the wrong way?
I think the biggest mistake I ever made was like one of the first ones.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Matt Keezer, creator of WTF Just Happened Today, which is, as he describes it, your essential guide to the shock and awe in national politics. He has been sending the newsletter for 9 years, and it has been his full-time job basically from the start and almost on accident. It is also almost entirely donations-based. Very rare to find a media business that works like this, especially in the creator economy. This was a good one. I think you're going to enjoy it. You have been running WTF Just Happened Today for 9 years. You started it in January 2017. From what I understand, the most basic version of the origin story is that you started it when Trump first became president as a way to personally keep up with this suddenly much more rapid and chaotic news cycle. But I want to hear the origin story just that first year, from idea to first issue to the end of 2017. Tell me about that first year.
Totally. So the idea for this thing was hatched over martinis at Buco di Beppo in DC after the Women's March. I was talking to my really good friend Jess from New York. My wife and I had like flown out for the Women's March to meet up with our group of friends from New York who had come down. And we did the whole thing all day. And over these martinis at Buco di Beppo, my friend Jez and I were talking about how hard it is to keep up with the news. And this is like, you got to time warp yourself back to that period of time when every piece of content was broken down into like 15 atomic parts and shared out a million times. And the algorithms were so crazy. Like you would see stuff that was super old and it would be confusing because that had been disproven or the story had changed and people were just completely, I don't know, like, confused.
Well, I think with the algorithms too, I'm pretty sure we were only like 1 or 2 years into Instagram having a nonlinear algorithm.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so Jess and I were talking about like, how do you keep up with the news? Like we came to this quick realization that here was a bunch of like privileged people who could take the time off work, travel across multiple states to show up for something that they cared about. And yet, like we have the interest and the time and the money to like pay for news. And yet like I feel less informed than I have ever felt. And I've always been very much a news junkie. Mm-hmm. It just became really clear to me that there was like a gap in the marketplace and that the news organizations weren't doing a great job servicing the needs of their readers. And so in like the back of the car on the way to JFK to fly out back to Seattle on like January 20th, 2017, I was just kind of like on Twitter grabbing links and throwing them into like an Evernote notebook of like news stories that felt like they would sort of, they were important in the moment and they would be like important, like looking back, like historically, they would like stand a test of time. And in just doing that exercise, it was like very clear that I was already more informed by just like grabbing them and reading those headlines. And so what I started doing was like, I would read the news and then just like write a quick summary of what I had read in my voice, like in a way that made sense to me. And what that really was just like a education hack for myself of read something, regurgitate it, and you'll better retain it. And I was like, oh, let's just do this.
Yeah.
Let's try this thing. We'll do it in public. We'll make it a 100-day challenge to like read and summarize the news every day and kind of see where it goes. And it, you know, truthfully, it wasn't about making it a business. It was like a project to do in public. And one of the things that I miss about the internet was like, there was this whole era where like the internet was fun. Mm-hmm. It was about possibilities. It was about like people doing cool things, trying things, experimenting. And I wanted to get back to, I wanted to do something in that space. And I think the other thing that always stood out to me was back in that era, there was tons of these like single serving websites that did one thing and one thing only. Like the being so narrowly scoped and having that constraint was actually like what made it great. And I always like use this example. There was a website called isitcoffeeweatheryet.com. And all it did was like use your, like your geolocation of your browser and the weather to be like, yes or no.
Yeah.
And being in New York, like, you know, there's like this whole,
is
like
the L train running as well
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, that was kind of like what was percolating in my head. And like, I like sort of, you know, spin up this blog and make my first effort at like putting together a blog post, not really knowing what I'm doing, but kind of like just leaning on experience and sort of like trying to make the thing that I want to make, like I needed. And then I'm like, oh, I need a domain name. And I'm just like click clacking into namecheap.com, like trying to find domain names that were like silly, like is it isitcoffeeweather.com? And I just sort of arrived at like, what the fuck just happened today? And it was like available, you know, I try to do like the WTF just happened or whatever, yeah. Like a million like iterations of that. But I was like, oh, this is available. This is ridiculous. Let's just do that. I think I like tweeted out starting, like, I'm going to track the news or something. And here's the link. And I posted on like Facebook maybe. And what happens next is like things that I don't control.
Yeah.
Basically the site just goes like viral immediately inside of these private Facebook groups. So I have all of this web traffic coming to my little Jekyll blog hosted on a GitHub Pages thing where I don't know what I'm doing. I have a full-time job already, like still.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to like figure out what is going on? Where is this traffic coming from? There's no attribution on it. It's just like in Google Analytics, it's just like not set, like whatever, organic not set or something like that.
Dark social.
Yeah, it was dark social. And I'm like, well, this must be coming from Facebook. Because like otherwise I'd see stuff like on Twitter. And what I immediately realized was because I put the name, like the publishing schedule in the name, now I needed to do the thing. And which was like cool. It was like fun. I'm like, all right, now I have like I'm on the hook.
Accidental nominal determinism.
And I don't know what compelled me to like stick that newsletter subscription box on the site, but that's the only reason I'm here today. We've all seen those viral sites. They come and go and they disappeared. And I think what was in the back of my mind was like, oh, this is another one of those moments for me happening to me. And let's try and capture some of that audience and see if we can sort of like build a flywheel here that can sustain. Because even for 100 days, like, you know, I don't think like you were going to sustain that energy just by like publishing a blog post and like sharing it on Twitter or Facebook or whatever at the time. So I didn't set out to like start a newsletter. It very much was like, oh, we're just going to do this now. Now I'm going to send a newsletter. I was using Tiny Letter and pretty much like 3 days later, like blew past like their like soft limit, which is like an amazing problem to have. But I also, you know, this starts like costing not only time to do it, but like real money.
Yeah.
And I'm like over on MailChimp being like, oh my God, like I spent several thousand dollars just like doing this project for fun, like funsies, you know? And I wrote this down because it was a good exercise to go back and pull up sort of like the TikTok of the timeline here.
Yeah, please.
So 27 days in on February 15th, 2017, I like send my newsletter. I put a little editor's note being like, hey guys, I'm determined to do this for 100 days, but like this is going to start costing me some like real money. I'm hoping to raise about $4,000 to cover the costs. And it was like, here's a Patreon link. Here's a PayPal link. Go to bed, wake up, and there's like $34,000 in that PayPal account.
Oh my God.
4 days later, I had about $2,500 in like monthly recurring revenue in Patreon, like from that process. And a couple of days later, that was over $3,000 in monthly recurring revenue. And then on day 90, I quit my job of starting this project to go full time. Wow. And do like a huge membership push around that. The calculus was basically like, if I did this full time and bet on myself, could I make this like an actual business that, you know, would pay me like a competitive salary? Mm. And that's like, that was 9 years ago. And here we are like still doing this thing very much in the same way. It's like, you know, once a day update, one newsletter a day, that's it. And it's completely supported by the readers using this ridiculous free pay whatever you want membership model where you don't get anything other than like feeling good about supporting something you want to see in the world. So that's kind of like, that's like the first like 100 days.
Yeah. That's insane. I didn't realize how much of it was so contained in that first 100 days. Really quick, too, I want to describe the product for anybody listening who has not subscribed, who has not seen it. So my quick summary is that you describe the day's news in one very long paragraph length sentence. Then there are half a dozen headlines and each one has an additional paragraph of context. And then maybe like 10 links to corroborating sources. And that's about it. That's like the entire product.
Totally. I describe it as like, I doom scroll the news so you don't have to.
Yeah.
And then I just compile like the executive summary with all the citations, like clearly labeled and right there. Again, it gets back to the idea of like a single serving website that does like one thing and does it consistently. It comes in the afternoon because like you have to look back on the day's news to like put the thing together.
So there's so much to get into here, like the way you've built the product to gather the news. What is it called?
Current Status.
Current Status. CurrentStatus.io. It's a website. From what I understand, this is like you were probably gathering all this manually at first, and then at some point you build this tool, which I think is open source, right? And now it's automated in this way. I'm always really interested in talking to people who have these aggregation curation style newsletters because it's one of those things that sounds so easy on paper, but actually is such a skill. The editing, you know, I asked somebody about this the other day, Rachel Mead Smith of the Words of Mouth newsletter, if you're familiar mm-hmm. with that one. And I asked her, what's the difference between aggregating, curating, and editing? And she said, the aggregating is what I do. I go out and find the stuff. And then the curating and the editing is the same thing. It's taking what I aggregated and making a product that is fit for my subscribers, for my readers. Tell me a little bit about how you've built over 9 years, built this skill, and then even automated to some extent, built this skill of finding a bunch of stuff and figuring out what's fit to serve your audience.
Totally. I think it goes back to kind of first principles around like an editorial scope. So I set out from the jump, it was, this is the news, national political news through the lens of the executive branch, then the congressional or legislative branch, and then the judicial branch, like specifically in that order. So the focus is always like through the president and what the president's doing and whatever like the president like collides with, right? So by keeping that focus, it allowed me to just like sort of narrow in and triage like the sort of content gathering focus, like yeah. what I was after. And so when I built this like tool called Current Status, it's woefully out of date. It's like half the like sort of sourcing that I like built into it like doesn't even work anymore. And this is going to be like a month-long like Claude Code project to sort of like revive it. And so the kind of what I did is I kind of built this system to ingest all this content, score it, and give me like a rough sort of like slice of like what the political web was talking about. That's not the only process that goes into this. Like
yeah.
I use that as like the sort of front line of defense, or like, you know, when I, you know, like after this call, I'll like pop it open, just kind of see what's happening, like what's updated. My normal process is twice a day I do this thing. Sit down with a fresh Chrome browser. Control T, new tab, New York Times. Control T, Washington Post, Politico, NPR. Let me do this in order though. It's New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, NPR, Associated Press, Reuters, The Guardian, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, CNBC, CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC. That's like, and I just open up all those homepages and I just like go scan the homepage, popping open new links for that. Like everything I see on there that feels like it fits the editorial mission for the day. Mm. Usually I'll drill down into like either the US or like political sections for all these sites. And I'll do this process. I'll just go right to left, just popping open hundreds of tabs. And just that like 2 hour window of just being heads down, like sourcing content.
Only 2 hours.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not reading anything at this point. I'm just like straight up just like news gathering. Mm-hmm. And what it is really just sort of this like crazy inefficient process of pattern matching. I'm seeing this story, and this story written and on the homepages of like all the major US sites. Those stories must be important. And I just, and then there's a huge amount of editing of like what's above the line, below the line. Is there like sort of like a meta narrative to tell?
Of the day.
Of the day. You know, sometimes there's like a court ruling that informs like this thing that happened that seemed unrelated, but it was very clear that like there's a sort of TikTok of the timeline here. I try and say that like, this is an inherently biased product. This is the news through like one person making decisions about like the relative importance of information. I try and do it in like an honest, trustworthy, transparent way. I try to own my mistakes. I try to engage with the readers. I try to like toe that line of being responsive and trying to meet their needs while also not being captured by the audience. Mm. And that's just like that's a difficult balance to strike. And, but that tension I think is where people feel heard and they feel like they're part of this product. And that's what makes this a little bit different from being just a straight utility product that is easily disrupted by AI today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just summarizing the news, right? To looking more at this, like this is a relationship product and the relationship with the reader is where the value lies. It's less in the utility. It's more in someone has found me to be a trusted source of information through all these activities that I do, like citing my sources, making public corrections.
I like to say that, you know, I mean, I don't like, this is a classic saying, right? That every business is a relationships business. I've taken to saying that every business is a hospitality business recently, which is kind of what you're describing. And I also love what you said about, you know, trying to be as transparent as possible. Just this morning in Creator Spotlight, we published, I didn't write it, Natalia, our assistant editor, wrote it, this piece that, what did we title it? I think it's Objectivity is Dead, Transparency is What Comes Next, something like this, where this idea that, you know, now that there are so many sources to find any bit of information and in algorithmic feeds, you know, ideological strong opinions travel easier, right? It's a distribution mechanism to have strong opinions. But basically that, you know, objectivity is nigh impossible to achieve in this environment, so transparency is what has replaced it, right? And so it sounds like you would agree with that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not the only, being transparent is like not the only thing, like activity you have to do to like find success and build trust, but no. It's a certain, like a certain component to it for sure.
Yeah, it's crucial. Okay, back to the audience capture, lack thereof. As far as I know, you have a little over 200,000 subscribers today, right?
Yeah, ebbs and flows. It's around that.
Yeah. I was churned with every issue. And how much of that came in that rush of the first year? And then how much have come in the 9 years since?
I think in the first 6 months of doing this project, I crossed 100,000 subscribers, which be like half my audience, right? And this is in an era before like Substack really existed. Yeah. They had just got off.
Newsletters weren't normal yet.
Yeah, it wasn't normal to like subscribe to like a media newsletter. And so it crossed about 100,000 people, like I want to say in the first 6 months. And then it was just this slow incremental like march up. But with that came a lot of attrition just because it's like a rather high churn product.
It's impossible to send a newsletter that gets zero unsubscribes. It's just part of the game.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think the growth slowed way down because couple of factors. One, people were getting like very fatigued by the news generally in 2017.
Don't tell me what happened today.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a hate watch kind of thing. And then the social companies started like changing their algorithms. And I've never like really had like a super strong like SEO game, in part because like the product doesn't lend itself well to like being like, here's a page about a specific story. It's because it's a compilation of things. But it does rank really well for people like rage typing into Google, like, what did Trump do today? What just happened?
Yeah.
So I get all this like weird side traffic, and some of it converts, some of it doesn't.
Hey, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider subscribing to the podcast. We release a new episode every Tuesday. All right, back to the show.
It's also a fun way to think about sort of history. I get these emails where people are like, hey, I didn't get your email today. And I'm like, oh, that's funny because you're on the list and I sent it to you and it says you opened it. And they're like, well, I didn't get it. Can you resend it to me? I'm like, sure. But like, why? Like what? It's on the blog. Like what up? And they're like, I print them out and I keep them for my grandson.
Okay. Like grandson. Wait. This brings up something that we have to talk about. When I first met you at the ONA conference back in September, you're on this panel, and I remember you saying something to the degree of like you didn't think you would end up having the audience that you do have, which is mostly women in their 50s and 60s. I think you said, you just said grandchild, which is what made me think of this. You thought it would be more of a, you know, millennial crowd trying to keep up with the news. And then I think partially because of this Facebook, private Facebook group, Women's March launch, obviously your audience tends to be liberal, and specifically liberal women who were born in probably the 70s, 60s.
Yeah. I didn't know that for a long time. And at one point when I was trying to do some paid growth, I uploaded the mailing list to Facebook's like lookalike tool. Mm-hmm. And it gave me the whole like demographic breakdown. And I was like, oh, what? Like, what is happening here?
Which for the audience who might not know, this is a tool where you could upload emails. And since Facebook tends to have people's emails, it can tell you a bit about what the makeup of this audience is.
Yeah, it was like, you know, your high level demographics, maybe some psychographic stuff. And then the whole point was that you could then like target lookalike audiences for paid acquisition. I never made it that far because the F-bomb in the URL was a non-starter for Facebook. So, I mean, like blessing and a curse there, because who knows how much money I would have wasted trying to like acquire low value leads. But it was an interesting insight. And it also, I think, explains like some of the reasons why I don't see social media growth. Like I don't see people like sharing stuff around on social media, especially not anymore. Mm-hmm. But I still have this like growth engine, which is primarily people forwarding the email to their friends and family.
Boomer behavior.
In like a very old school method. every once in a while you see someone with like a dozen opens, you know, and you're like what happened there? And it's because they forwarded it to like their Indivisible group or something. And like everyone opened that. And there's this really like touching, handwritten letter that I received like kind of in that early period where, you know, like I didn't really know like who I was like communicating with. I get a lot of emails and, you know, you see names like Phyllis and you're like, oh, you must be of that, over 65 cohort. And I was just kind of struggling with like, how do I reach a younger audience or whatever? And I received this like physical letter handwritten, and it was a woman thanking me for the newsletter because it was the thing that she could bond with her grandmother over while her grandmother was in hospice care. And every day the newsletter would come, they would print it out. She would wheel her grandmother out to like the garden and they would read the news, like my newsletter. And, after her grandmother passed, she like sends, like writes me this letter being like, thank you so much. Like this was a really pivotal, like, moment in my relationship with my grandmother who's no longer here. And I'm like, this is incredible. This is like what it's about. It's like people connecting over the news in a way that's like personal. There's a relationship there. It's about establishing better habits with the news. And what better way to like have good like media habits than to like share that with like your grandmother? Like, it's such a cool experience.
That's such an amazing like artifact of your audience's appreciation. I want to talk about the product market fit. You were mentioning this at the beginning, and specifically the fact that you are able to monetize in the way that you monetize, which is through the tip jar function and then subscriptions or memberships, which again, as you said earlier, they're not getting anything extra. They're just supporting anything. And so you said kind of right product, right place, right time, right framing, which is this is a Trump bump kind of product, right? Which is when people talk about Trump's first presidency, and Washington Post got a lot of subscribers. Didn't necessarily keep them. That's neither here nor there. But it's this demographic. It's this the right product for the right demographic, which is, to be reductive, maybe people who would when their local radio station is doing a membership drive, supporters drive, they would probably donate to that too, right? That's kind of what the way you monetize as well. Is this, I don't know, it seems like you could have planned it in this cynical way. Like the character I'm getting of you, like my image of you increasingly as we speak, is you kind of are this, you know, 80s, 90s internet guy, and you're not that old. This, you know, I'm not dating you here, but the kind of like early promise of the internet as counterculture and building these things, and this sort of like, I think the phrase "you can just do things" often is co-opted in this sort of this right wing way, but it also has this spirit of early internet entrepreneurship trying to make the world a better place. I think you have like punk roots too. You started a record label when you were in college, radio DJ. So my image of you is that you are this sort of like maybe born 20 years too late or something. Like, I don't know the exact timing here. I don't know how old you are, but born 20 years too late, internet entrepreneur guy who just happened to make the right product at the right time. And that's sort of the overarching story I'm getting here.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I grew up probably 20 years too late. My favorite bands are like the DIY DC hardcore punk bands who didn't like the world that was like around them. So they just created their own world. They created their own thing. Right. And, you know, there's Jella Biafra from the Dead Kennedys once said, "Don't hate the media, become the media." And he was kind of talking about sort of like a different thing than this, but that has always resonated with me and stuck with me from like the jump. Mm-hmm. And that's part of like what's so cool about the internet is like you don't need permission. You can just do it. But if you do it in a responsible, ethical, moral, like value-based way, I think you have a better chance of like finding like lasting success and finding like sort of your crowd or group that like builds that community. And so when I like went to like go full time and really figure out how to make this like not just a bunch of tip jar contributions, but like make it a more resilient business, you know, like I looked at, should we do like an actual subscription, like paywall type of thing? And immediately discarded that because like, I'm not the original journalist producing this original like reporting. It felt really like shitty to try and like cannibalize that with like a curated aggregated product. So I threw that out. It was like, okay, sponsorship ads, like no way, like non-starter, you know, like nothing like really against that stuff, but like that just didn't like fit my like ethos and values. And like, I think I've always maintained that I will keep doing this for as long as people will keep supporting me. And to me, what that says is I am producing enough value worth paying for that I should keep going. And that the moment that like that equation doesn't work out and the equilibrium goes away, that tells me that like this product no longer serves like a valuable part in enough people's lives to continue doing. And like, we're just going to stop when that happens. And
I want to read some of the numbers because it is working for now. We'll get to the when you may or may not stop in a bit. But some of the numbers from the membership page of your website, I'm not going to read the whole thing because you're very thorough, very transparent here. If anybody listening is very curious about the specific numbers, go check it out. But you say that about 2% of readers underwrite the product, which unlocks free access for everybody else, costs about $2.09 per year to send to one subscriber. So with a current average contribution of $5.93 a month, each member effectively pays for 54 free readers every month. And then if you back out the math, it's about $227,000 a year to run this. You break down how this contributes to your living wage, self-employment tax, operating costs. You're very transparent about this, and you are like literally down to the cent. Talk to me about why you have chosen to be so extremely transparent, and also whether this ever backfires on you.
So going back to like that, just like making the jump to go full time, I really felt like it was necessary to just be as honest and transparent and try and build that trust from day one. And the other part of it was just a deep uncomfortableness with like asking for money. I didn't at the, like, you know, go back to like 2017, there weren't a lot of like creators making a living on like a patronage model.
Yeah.
You know, Patreon was still a very new product. It wasn't common to directly pay people for content.
Yes, it's still something you only did to streamers and news companies.
Exactly. And again, like that idea of, I'm not the one producing this original journalism. I'm just the one like providing a like a value curation over the top. I don't know why I chose to do it that way. I think I was just like so in my head around like the sort of like open source software community around transparency that like this was just a natural extension of that. And I didn't think I'd be here like 9 years later either. So I think it was like just a worthy experiment in just being radically honest and transparent. But it's one of the things that really helps when it gets time to do like these quarterly member drives. So I do these week long, 3 to 4 times a year drives where it's very like focused on like membership, why your support matters, what it funds, like why you should do it. Like using math was like a much like a very natural way of, like, to get there. But the like the framing of like, you know, 2% unlocks like this for 98% of people and that it's free as a result is like a really powerful framing. And then to go further and say like, this is how much like your $5.93 a month like supports, like you are directly underwriting. Like
it's an emotional and data backed appeal.
Yeah. And like when I do that, I get these emails being, when you become a member, you get your receipt email and then you get a follow-up email from me that asks like, what compelled you to give today? And that qualitative feedback has been gold. It is the by far the best thing I do in terms of like audience listening, because it's things like I can afford $6 a month or $5 a month, and I want to see this thing exist. It's I'm on a fixed income, but this is more valuable to me than the New York Times, which like I think is ridiculous. But $5 is a lot cheaper than like the $49 a month or whatever for the Times subscription, right? And this is also plumbing at a depth that is like a that fits their I don't know their like where they're at in the world, like it's the right amount of like content or news for them, and that's like all they can do, right?
To me too, like what people pay for with something like this, and some people listening may have heard me give this analogy before, but I like to think of information, the information marketplace, as like sushi, right? There's the people who go out and catch the fish and they're doing this primary sourcing, and there's the people who take it to the fish market, and there's the chefs who go to the fish market and buy it, and they know what to look for, and they have these knives and these specialized skills and tools to break it down into more usable information. And then there's like this end consumer. You know, you go to a nice sushi dinner, omakase style, maybe there's 12 pieces coming out, and the sushi chefs are just serving one bite at a time. You don't even need to use chopsticks. You just grab it and eat it, and it's this perfectly ordered 12 single bites, which – and I, the opposite of this to me is like going to a bad – it's not necessarily bad, but a steakhouse, a bad steakhouse that serves you a steak and gives you – a horrible steak knife, and you have to cut it up yourself, and you're going to kind of mangle this steak, right? And what you're like, your customers are people who want that omakase experience. They want things fully processed. They don't have the time to go and look for the things. They don't necessarily want to go cut the steak. Now my metaphor starts to fall apart a little bit, but you understand what I'm saying, right? Like that's that people pay because you are doing this great service of creating these little bites for them every day.
Yeah, exactly. And the it proves the model of like, let's create something that's aligned top to bottom, like incentive wise. And the measurable value is like literally whether or not people pay, right?
Yeah.
And so, it's very much like a create more value than you capture sort of thing. Like, could I push that conversion rate up? Yep. Would I feel awesome about it? Probably, because I would like be able to hire someone or something.
Yeah.
But the equilibrium is such that like this thing works as is. And this was a personal project that became a full-time job. And like, I'm playing with house money. And that is such as like an amazing experience.
Are you the only person working on it right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to talk about what I'll call Podgate. And you know what I'm about to ask about. So maybe we might need a better name than Podgate, but you have a podcast that is a quick summary. It's like 6 minutes of what's in the newsletter each day. A couple months back, I believe, maybe longer, you started using this AI text-to-voice tool. And previously, this is in your FAQ. It's quite detailed. You wrote that you, over 8 years, I think, you'd spent over $150,000 paying a human voice actor to read this for you, to read the podcast. And it generated no direct revenue. You say, I'm quoting, that is not a financially viable way to run a small business. Makes a ton of sense. You switched to doing this because this tool became available after you had gone on a hiatus with the podcast once you decided to stop making sense. And now there's great text-to-voice tools. So you started using them because it's better to have the podcast this way than to not have a podcast at all. And this was a small controversy in the WTF community. Tell me more.
So I always felt that there was a... when I was paying someone to produce and read the newsletter version for audio, it always felt like there was a gap I unnecessarily inserted in there, where like I separated myself from the work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And not in like a terrible, malicious sort of way. Like it just, these products can be so parasocial that to have like this product by Matt be read by this guy named Joe, there was a confusion there. And to be clear, like the podcast is really just like an audio version of the work. You know, there's no host, co-host kind of thing. It's a 4 to 6
no added commentary. It's just what you get in the newsletter.
Yeah. If anything, it's like a slightly tighter version because it's revised for audio. Going into the 2024 election, I didn't know like the outcome of the election. And I didn't know what kind of business like I would have in 2026 and beyond. And one of the thoughts was I need to kind of get back to basics and sort of pull in all my expenses. So like I eliminated a bunch of like little tools and applets I had like been paying for to save some money. Not that I was in like dire straits or anything, but you know, you could just feel
batten
like
down the hatches a bit. Just make sure that you are set up for the long term. If you're committing to doing this for the next 4 years of this presidency, that you don't know what's going to happen, let's make sure I can do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a tour of duty. Like, what do I need to like re-up for the tour of duty? And one of that was like to get like crisper on the finances. And here was a product. My single biggest like outlay of expenses was like producing this podcast that like, man, I don't know, like maybe a 1,000 people listen to a day, and it generated no revenue because I didn't do ads or sponsorship. There's no easy way to get someone to go from like listening on their smart speaker to like jump into the website to punch in their credit card information to pay for this thing that's free. Like it's just really hard. And so I decided to pause it. Wasn't kill it, but like pause it, was figure out how to retool this and like make another go at it in a way that made like financial sense to do it in a sustainable way. And I heard from a lot of people that they missed the audio version. And I was like, this is weird. Like
all 1,000 of them.
Yeah. Like the analytics do not like bear this out, but maybe I'm missing something. I don't know. And so spent a few months trying to figure out how to get there. Sort of in that time, like tools like Descript and 11 Labs sort of like really get good. And I mean, I think in general, the sort of AI world has made like a couple step functions in the last like 12 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. And so after a year of like having no audio edition, I wanted to bring it back. It was the number one thing people had asked for in like surveys and just through like, you know, emails inbound. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do this in my voice, but I don't have the time to read this every day because it's not just like one take, sit down, read the news. These things take a little bit of time. There's a little bit of editing. There's a little like zhuzh in it. And also like I have a hard stop every day when I have to go pick my child up from school. I do not have the bandwidth to do this. So the only way I could figure out how to like add this thing was to clone my voice, use a text-to-speech tool to take what I work, my words, my writings, and turn it into an audio product so that it presented as me and I was responsible for it. And I thought I was giving the audience like what they had asked for. And it turns out, I think I misunderstood the number of people, especially on my list, who happened to like the like cohort of people who are young happened to be like extremely anti AI.
This well, and I didn't. Let me interrupt for a second. I think this is a problem of like this is your when we were talking about product market fit earlier. Your audience is this very liberal leaning audience, probably pretty anti tech audience. So I mean, I'm getting ahead of it here, but it makes perfect sense.
It does in retrospect. At the time, I was like, hey, I'm just trying to give you the audio version, guys. Like all 1,000 of you. Like maybe if we push that up a little bit, cool. But like, I'm just trying to like add like a little bit more to the product and respond to like user needs. And what kind of transpired was I received a ton of like really like personally like terrible like hate mail from my own readers who'd been with me forever. And it sucked. And it was like a terrible thing to be like, I worked really hard to get this thing up that I was really proud of. And all I'm hearing is like how I'm an asshole. And like, how dare I? And I can completely empathize and respect like anyone's point of view on these tools. Like I can't even say I'm like fully like settled on where I land on this whole debate. I also wouldn't say like using a text-to-speech tool is like the most egregious use of like AI. I also found like a deep irony in people being so like angry with me for doing this while they're sending it from their Gmail account. And I'm like, you know, like Gemini is built into that.
This, right? Well, this to me, you could have done this 15 years ago with a text to voice. There have been text to voice products for decades, right?
Yeah.
It's just that now, and I don't want to get too deep into like the AI conversation, but the term AI means everything and nothing, right? It's one of these terms where like if you had just done this 15 years ago with a much worse text to voice product, one, people probably wouldn't have liked it because it would have been an inferior product, but two, they also wouldn't have cared and there would have been no controversy here.
Yeah.
It's really just that it's this word.
Totally. And like my perspective was this is a way to expand my like capacities as like a solo operator who doesn't have the budget to like hire someone to do this. And, you know, people like to make the argument, oh, you get volunteers. Well, that just like shifts the cost of labor back to me as a manager of people. And like, I just don't, I have neither the time nor the money for that. And that's like an unfortunate truth.
Yeah.
And it's like really unfortunate what happened. I learned a really good lesson in basically what happened was I replied to one email who told me F you for using AI. And I said, grow up. And then I got kind of like dragged on Blue Sky. And it wasn't like I shouldn't have replied. I get that. I was also really frustrated after like hundreds of these things rolled in. Yeah. And then there was like a dog pile where like this was clearly being forwarded to other people who then like dogpiled on me. And it was just like, this sucks. I didn't get into this to like get dragged like this when I was trying to do something like
work helpful. So hard.
Yeah. You know, and like I've read enough psychology to know that like this is the sort of like experience that can harden one's view on something. Like you could either like back away from it and not do it, or you could double down and like fully like embrace AI and AI tools and everything and be like, F you, like I'm doing it. So like I had to like really temper myself going through this experience. And like, the big takeaway for me is like, this is the first time I got dragged on social, like since starting this project. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was like, that's pretty good. Like to not like be like subject of like nonsense, like internet banter, like over all these years, just this one time and this one use case. And like, what was really interesting afterwards was like, I went through and I looked at all the unsubscribe emails, and these are people that had been with me for like many years, but these are also readers who had never contributed anything to the success of this project. And so in some ways, like, fine, like at the end of the day, this is a small business and it requires people contributing to the success of it. And if, you know, this does no longer aligns with your values, or this is not for you, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
The question is, because you're still doing the podcast with this, are the numbers up or are they down on the podcast?
It's like literally the same. I'm like, I think the one thing, the one thing I haven't done is like promoted very much. I think part of it is because like I realize there's a strong sensitivity here, and kind of in the background right now, I'm trying to figure out is there a better way to thread this needle, a better way to approach it? How can I like change like how I talk about it? You know, like calling it a podcast using AI was like the original sin. You know, it's like a audio companion edition that really is like a text-to-speech tool.
Have there been like, are there one or two other times in your 9 years of doing this where you've stepped on something the wrong way like this?
Yeah. I mean, and this wasn't really
also just any kind of mistake, like in the way you ran the business that hurt you financially. And I'm looking for like two mistakes that you've made in the last day.
I got some good ones. Oh, I'm going to give you a couple and then like you can edit the ones out that you don't want.
Actually, we're gonna edit out everything, but it's gonna be all oops, all mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. I think one mistake was the Biden Trump debate. I like wrote that like how I saw it, which was like, here are two elderly men who are like fumbling over themselves, and this is terrible. This is such a shit show for America. And what I forgot was that my audience is like people over 65 primarily. And what that resulted in is people feeling defensive and seeing their own mortality in that moment. And that sucked because they were responding to what I wrote from this emotional place about how they felt. Wow. And what I was trying to communicate was like, these guys are neither of them are qualified to run to be president of the United States anymore. Like this is embarrassing for America. So that's kind of like an example of like forgetting to remember who your audience is and how they're going to respond to something.
And that they're not you.
Yeah. And I try to keep the reader in mind when I do this stuff, because like, this isn't really like just about my perspective. It's about like what the product represents to all of these like 200,000 people who will all have a different sort of like take and slice on life. There's that. I think another one was in the early days, I think that was like back when, what's the site where you like you get people to back a product and like it?
Oh, Kickstarter?
Kickstarter, yeah. Kickstarter was popular back then. And I was like, oh, like we should do perks. We'll do like stickers and buttons and t-shirts and whatever, postcards, like WTF branded postcards to write your like representatives. And it was like fun and cool to like do this. We sourced all the designs from the community. The problem was like, I didn't anticipate how expensive merch is to like do like fulfillment. And I ended up being like spending so much more time at the post office than I was willing to do. It just became in the shipping business for this like weird, like I'd rather someone give me $5 a month for like 5 years than buy two $30 t-shirts once. You know what I mean? Like the lifetime value of that member is like so much greater if they're paying me directly. And it turned out after like talking to people, like I explained like why I was getting rid of perks. They were like, oh yeah, I don't really want the sticker. I don't want the t-shirt. Like I was like, okay, this is an easy decision.
Just support me directly. We have no merch in the middle that takes all the money anyways.
Yeah. But like the learning there was like, some people do like stickers.
Yeah.
And there's something about like having these fun objects that are like physical artifacts that can live on a refrigerator or something.
Yeah. Okay. In an interview with our mutual friend, Liz Kelly Nelson, a little over a year ago, you said, I'm quoting you here from this, I am mentally committed to doing it for another 4 years. I think of it as like a tour of duty. You said this earlier. In 4 years, that will be 12 years I've been doing this. I'll have done 3 different presidencies. And at the end of that, I can decide whether or not to keep doing this or do something else. So there's 2 questions here. The first one is, for the remainder of this tour of duty, 3 years, do you have anything planned that you really want to accomplish? Or you were just talking about these merch experiments, something like that you want to do? Or is it sort of stay the path? I know what I'm doing. I'm going to keep doing this for at least the next 3 years. Or do you have like a specific thing planned you want to try?
I think the challenge that I have is that the product today is basically the exact same product it was 9 years ago.
It's complete.
Yeah. And it's, you know, for someone who likes to make things and tinker and try stuff, I have tried a ton of experiments over the years, forums and comments and Q&As and all these sort of things. And the audience always like came back to like, I just want the utility tool. And on one hand, that's like a really like defeating position to be in, be like, cool, I'm just going to like click clack on my keyboard today and like churn out yet another post. Like, how do I like fill my bucket, and how do I like stay engaged myself? And so I run all these little experiments on the side as like, tinkering, you know, like I've never wanted to like put myself in the product as like the main character, even though I am. I think the product works better when, if you stripped away the branding and like the little like emoji reaction that I do every day, like it's a pretty straight like executive summary of the news.
Yeah.
That's like sourced and cited. And, but there's these little moments for like personal expression where people realize there's a real human at the other end of this thing. Like a typo is like actually a positive.
Yeah.
It's like, it sucks to have a typo and send out like this thing to a bunch of people, but it's awesome to get like hundreds of emails being like, you have a typo. Oh, here's a mistake I made.
Because it's a reminder you exist.
Exactly. Which is more important today than ever, with like the AI tools coming out. And we're going to, the media like newsletter ecosystem is going to be flooded with like low grade, like AI summarized content or generated content. And it probably already is, like, it's only going to get worse. But like, for instance, one time I sent out the like default like starter template that I use every day, which is literally all lorem ipsum. And I sent this thing out and I just have thousands of emails being like, I don't speak Latin. What is this?
And I was, your base doesn't necessarily know what lorem ipsum is.
I was like, joke's on you. It's not even Latin. It's just like gobbledygook. But so like for me, the things that have been really exciting me are like, how do I connect with the audience on like a personal level and find ways to connect, like, to deepen this relationship while doing the thing that they show up for. It's like, come for the news product, stay for the relationship. And so I'll do things like, I don't tell people like how to think about the news, like, or give my opinion really, but like occasionally I'll be like, hey, this is kind of messed up. Like, how are you like handling this? Or like, how are you feeling about this?
Yeah.
And I'll get all these like very raw, honest responses from readers being like, yeah, this sucks. I think about like my grandkids, or I think about like, you know, in my day, things were like so much better. Like, it's really sad that my children don't get to experience the world the way it looks like the world I had, right? What I learn regularly is like, the more I connect with the readers at a personal level, the deeper this relationship goes and the more trust that they have in me. And I think that's really where the value lies, like for creators who are creating, like, especially like what I do, like a curated aggregator product. I think it's like where the value lies moving forward and how you build a resilient business and defend against like sort of the AI slop that is coming for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so like some of the things I'm in a kind of a quiet period on this right now, but I'm like trying to get it out the door is, what are the things I can do routinely that regularly like connect with readers at this level without interrupting the product? And so one of them is this idea of just like a call and response where I like share how I'm feeling about something specific, solicit feedback. I'll like cobble that together and put together a summary and be like, here's what you guys said. Mm. And what's really cool about that is like, I get readers being like, I didn't respond to you, but I feel so seen. Like, it's so great knowing that other people feel the same way I do. And it reminds me that like so many people consume this content alone, like on their phone, on their computer, they're just at home or on the bus or whatever it is. And when you create these like moments of like a shared community, like it's not a real community. It's like a shared reality, sort of like a connection point.
Yeah.
People really respond to that in a positive way. So a lot of what I'm trying to think about is like how to do more of that. On the anniversary of the 2024 election, I created a little tool that was like, it was like very, what do you call it? Like a Mad Lib style, like form builder, where it was like, before the election, I was feeling like this. After the election, I was feeling like this. And a year later, I'm feeling like this. And as I looked to the future, and it was like right in the blank. And, you know, it was like a build your last year in one sentence experience. And what I did is I built a little page that would live update in real time as these responses came in. And like, you know, maybe it was a little like gimmicky, but I made it as like, as if they were like handwritten post-it notes and it's different colors and sizes and all that. For me, that was like a fun thing to do, is like build this little tool. But the value was like in just seeing all of these responses come in like super raw and emotional. And
wow,
you know, you give people an opportunity to say something, they usually will like fill it. But if you give them like a sort of like a safe space that feels anonymous, that is anonymous, like in this case it was, like people will say some like real powerful shit, and it's like really, really cool. And a lot of what I'm doing is trying to think about how to really double down into that space, because I think it just reveals like a certain humanity that we lose sight of in all of the terrible news, and like thinking about running businesses and, you know, like kind of get back to basics. And like, you know, Joe Strummer says something like, you need to drag humanity back to the center of the ring, and like, let's like pay attention to that for a while. And the other thing St. Joe Strummer also said was, without people, you're nothing. And I think that's like one of the most true things I've ever, ever heard. And it carries with me every day.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking of asking, do you think you'll be doing this for another tour of duty? But it's probably too easy or too early to figure that out. And I really love where you just brought us. So I think we'll end it right here.
Sounds great. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. And listener, we will see you next week.
Hi there, my name's Tom. I'm the producer of the Creator Spotlight podcast. I've just made a playlist on our YouTube channel of our top 10 episodes. So whether you're new here or you've been watching and listening for a little while, check out that playlist to make sure you've seen and heard our top 10 most popular episodes. I'll keep the playlist updated as the top 10 changes. If you're on YouTube, just click on that box over there. That's our top 10.